So it's a little late. It's already nearly 8:30. So we won't talk long this evening. Maybe half an hour. So I'm not going to read anything. But I thought what we could do is, if anyone has any questions about Srila Prabhupada or, you know, about devotional service in general, then we could have a little session. Maybe I can illuminate some of your concerns with some practical examples from Srila Prabhupada's dealings and activities. So if you like, then anybody that has a question, then fire away. Yes, Prabhu. Everybody heard the question? Yeah. Well, it's very clear that Prabhupada did want Varnashram to be introduced. He made the point in that February 14th conversation in 1977. Although he had spoken a lot about Varnashram, I think in 74, there was actually a little booklet that came out with some conversations where Prabhupada was talking about establishing Varnashram, and that was where a lot of impetus came for starting these farming communities. And Prabhupada did talk a lot about, you know, self-sufficient farming communities and having a place where devotees could live peacefully and become self-sufficient, grow your own grow your own food, make your own cloth, make your own houses, and grow your own medicine. So if you have those four things, then you can be pretty well self-sufficient. So Prabhupada favoured that. He encouraged us to do that everywhere. And in 1977, in the middle of the year, Prabhupada was saying that if he got a little better, then that would be the next phase of the movement that he wanted to, you know, concentrate on. He was going to go to the farming communities and do a tour just at the farming communities, and he said, you know, make them strong, because he never got the opportunity to do that. When we went to Hyderabad, this will be the first chapter of my next volume of Transcendental Diary. Prabhupada went down to Hyderabad in early December of 76, and we had just gotten all the legal work done so that we could officially take over about 600 acres of land in Hyderabad, or just outside Hyderabad. And when we left Vrindavan, Prabhupada got in the car, Jagadish was with him, and then as Prabhupada sat down, he said, now we are going to begin a new phase of this movement. And then when Jagadish looked at him, he didn't say immediately what it was, but Jagadish looked at him and then he said, Varnashram. So he was keen on that, and he had a plan in Hyderabad where he was going to set up these small villages, not exactly villages, but groupings of houses, where local land, local farmers could come, they could build a house, have a few acres of land, you know, keep a cow, a couple of cows, and worship Krishna. And that was the whole plan. It was very simple. It was no more than that. It wasn't complex. Somehow or another, the managers in Hyderabad couldn't get it together to do that nicely. And later on, not so long after Prabhupada left, then the man that donated the land, then he became, I don't know what all the reasons were, but he became disturbed with the devotees, so he tried to take all the land back again. So it became a huge legal battle for many years, and so that whole project collapsed. But 2 months after we were there, of course, we were in Mayapur, and Prabhupada did tell us very clearly that, and I had brought it up with him, that previously you had said that we should start Varnashram, but we weren't able to do it. We didn't do that. And Prabhupada said, You know, the time wasn't right then, but now it is. And he, you know, pretty clearly explains there the basics, but he didn't go into elaborate details. He expected that we should be able to work it out from the information that was in his books about, you know, what a Bound Ashram system or society, how it would function, but we would have to apply our intelligence in order to implement it in the modern day and age. You know, there's always adjustments that can be made. Sometimes devotees get this idealized vision of a Bound Ashram society, like a perfect society as it was in Lord Krishna's time. But according to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, you cannot recreate the past. That is not possible. Because even if you have all the theoretical information, the practical circumstances are different. They were living in Dwarka Yuga. We're living in Kali Yuga. So things are vastly different. We have to interact to some degree with the, you know, the regular Kami world, and there are obligations, whether we like it or not, you know, to the state government and, you know, various ways. And just the whole way the economy works now is it's very entangling. So it's proved to be very difficult to set up even a simple community that is self-sufficient. I think one of the main difficulties is that our devotees are addicted to electricity. And because of that, then living simply on the land has proved to be tremendously hard work for us. And living on the land is hard work. It's very hard work, you know, when you're growing crops, and especially if you're trying to do it for a larger community. It's very hard physical work, and we're just not used to it, and we're not inclined to it. So you get a few rare souls that, you know, actually enjoy living on the land, and the rest of us, you know, we want our computers, we want our electric heaters, we want, you know, hot water, we want all these different things. So you know, some adjustments have to be made there. Then also, it's been difficult for the devotees to figure out how, you know, when you have a Bound Ashram system and there are divisions of labor, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya and Shudra, that at the same time as Vaishnavas, we're actually supposed to be transcendental to that, and we just chant Hare Krishna. And that was one of the arguments that we brought up with Srila Prabhupada. It wasn't an argument, but it was a doubt. And then Prabhupada said, well, they're not even chanting their 16 rounds. He said, actually, we're not going to give, we should not be giving Brahman initiation to everybody, because not everybody can chant the 16 rounds. So if they're not even doing that, then they're not up to Brahmanical standards, and that means Bound Ashram system is needed. But if you designate people, you're a Sudra, you're a Vaishya, you know, you're a Kshatriya, then they tend to resent it, or at least the Sudras do. They don't like to be labeled as Shudras. No, I'm a Vaishnav. But a Vaishnav is actually beyond a Brahmana. To be a Vaishnav is not a cheap thing. You actually, your character and your behavior has to be so exalted that it's beyond that of even a Brahmana. And if you read the descriptions of a Brahmana's behavior, you know, even that is very difficult to live up to. So, but we've had difficulties in kind of getting devotees to accept these designations. Maybe it'll gradually come. I don't know. We don't want to designate people in a discriminatory way either, or at least I'll say a negatively discriminatory way, because there's nothing wrong with discrimination. You know, discrimination has become a dirty word in politics, because it's always taken at its negative aspect. But, you know, there is good discrimination, and that is the function of the intelligence, to know you know, how to engage a person according to their nature. And that means to know what the differences are in the natures and to be able to properly advise a person, you know, how they can keep body and soul together, which is what, you know, social life is all about. Earn a living, have enough food, have a place to stay. Everybody practically will get married, so how to bring up your children, have an educational system for them, and at the same time make spiritual progress. So it requires good management, it requires wisdom, and I don't think that we've had a lot of wisdom in the movement, because after Prabhupada left, you know, I was 26 years old when I became a GBC of three countries. So at 26 years old, you're not very wise, I can tell you. You may have a little intelligence if you're lucky. And you certainly have a lot of passionate energy, you know, that you want to dedicate to Krishna. But wisdom is something that comes with age. It comes with experience. So now, you know, we're getting to a point where there are many of the senior devotees that are getting into their 50s and 60s and 70s. And if you look and see in the ordinary world, people that are, you know, successful politicians and, you know, managers of human society, it usually happens in their 40s and 50s and 60s. That's the period. So we've only just started to get, you know, one sector of ISKCON that is actually becoming like elder, wiser people. And we've had an imbalance in one sense, you know, over the last 20 years, because we don't have that older generation that, you know, is there to steady us down, you know, and with their experience point out to us, you know, the actions that we perform, whether they'll actually have a good result or a negative result. So we've been struggling a lot because of our, you know, newness, inexperience, just as human beings, and then also with the fact that we don't have a Vanashram society that we can actually emulate. There's nothing to look at. We have the theory, but we don't have a practical manifestation of it. So we've seen that in setting up something which is totally new, in one sense, it's a very much a trial and error process. And when you're learning things by trial and error, you have to be very patient. And patience is also not an attribute that Western society, you know, is imbued with, especially Americans. They're very impatient. They want everything to happen yesterday. You know, but it doesn't happen that way. And of course, all the early devotees in this movement were Americans. Most of the leaders in this movement are Americans because of that, because they were the first wave. And so it's, again, it's something that we have to learn, how to be very patient and not expect that we're going to do everything in 1 year or 5 years or even 15 or 20 years. It may take us a few generations. There again, who knows how the world situation, you know, will turn. Prabhupada didn't tell us to form these self-sufficient communities for nothing. He wanted us to be able to stand alone, you know, and not be dependent, very much at least, on the outside material arrangements. And there has to be a reason for that. And, you know, you only have to look at the news every single day to realize the planet is very rapidly being run down, you know, by the avaricious activities of, you know, the gross materialists, who were very intent on just raping the planet as much as they can. You know, despite, you know, the last 30 years of the so-called ecological movement, they destroyed more of the Amazon forest last year than they have done in the last 10 years. It's increasing, it's not decreasing. They intend to chop the Amazon forest down to one third of its original size. So who knows what that's going to do to the world weather patterns, the world ecology, and that's only one area. You go to places like Indonesia, they don't have any idea about preserving anything. At least the Brazilian government's been under some pressure from the West. But, you know, then the West itself is not willing to curtail their consumption of energy and resources. They want to try to manage it so that we'll last a little bit longer, but they're not willing to let nature actually have its own way. This has all happened in the last 150 years since industrialization. So industrialization has actually brought the world to the brink of an absolute disaster. And we have yet to see where that limit will be reached. It might be in our lifetimes. It almost certainly will be in the lifetimes of our children. So, you know, maybe 20 years, maybe 50 years, who knows. But there's going to be some major changes on the planet. I think most of us, or anybody who's had any information about what's happening, has that kind of conviction. The UN commissioned a report which was written up by about, I don't know, several hundred scientists. It took them years to compile it. Which is really, it's like a state of the planet statement. That report came out early this year or just last year. And it's a very, very gloomy read. I haven't read the whole thing, but I read the summary of it. And even their best scientists are predicting that in 20 years' time, you know, we're going to be looking at major disasters all over the planet in all the major resources. You know, water and just regular food crops and everything. But there's nothing that they can do about it. They're moving headlong into that. So there is something to be said, you know, for coming to a country like Croatia or the Ukraine, where I saw was there last year, where I still see many people. They have their little patch, their little garden, they grow vegetables, they grow some grains, they grow some flowers, they grow a little fruit. People are still doing that. In the West, people don't do that anymore practically. When I was a kid, I remember I was born in 1950. And that was, you know, just a few years after the Second World War in England. And people were so poor at that time because the war had stripped them of all their resources, even though they won, so-called won. But actually, the whole economy of the country was very bad. And people were on rationing for, you know, 5-6 years. They'd rationing coupons to get certain commodities. So the government gave out plots of land, small plots of land called allotments. And everybody, or most people, had their own little allotment. And they would go there and they would grow food. That was what it was for. But nowadays you see the same areas, the allotments are still there, but nobody does that. Hobby gardeners, sometimes they go. But nobody does anything serious with them anymore. Because you take it for granted that everything that you need is in the supermarket. You know, go to Tesco's, go to Sainsbury's, you know, and any fruit that you want is there. It doesn't matter what the season. You can get anything out of season, in season. Nobody knows what the seasons are anymore, you know, because of their industrialized endeavors. You know, they ship things from one place in the world to another place in the world, and you know, by artificial means, they make everything stay on the supermarket shelves for longer than, you know, they would normally do. So, people are becoming more and more dependent on all these artificial systems. And at the same time, you can see that they're very, actually very finely balanced. So, how long they'll be able to keep on with this balancing act, we don't know. But in the meantime, it would be good if, you know, we could have some devotional communities that are a little self-sufficient, seriously self-sufficient, growing crops, you know, growing your own food, growing your own flowers, and living peacefully. And then, you know, have your own educational system, start up a little school. We have like that in Australia. We have a school that's been running now for about 25 years. And that's, you know, quite nice. But still, there's tremendous amount of dependency that we have on these artificial systems. So it would be nice, and, you know, that entails rural life is more akin to Varnashram in many respects. It's a more natural way of life, and it's a more natural social system because they're complementary. Agrarian way of life is very complementary to Varnashram, because what is Varnashram? You look at the Vaishyas, what is their business? It's stated in Bhagavad Gita. Growing crops and looking after the cows. And the cows were very important in an agrarian society because half your economy depended on the cows. Getting milk and, you know, all of its byproducts. Using the cows for, or at least the bulls, for ploughing and tilling the field. And that's where you got your grains from. So your major, you know, the one thing that you do need is food. And the cows played a major role in supplying food. The bulls were supplying, by their labour, you know, all the different kinds of crops that you grow in the field. And the cows are supplying from their udders all the milk that you need, which is necessary. It has all the essential vitamins for keeping the body healthy and strong. So cows were a very, very valuable commodity. Now nobody cares for them. 100 years ago, 150 years ago, sometimes people in the countryside, they would kill a bull or something at a festival, you know, and have the meat. But meat eating was relatively rare. People may eat meat, you know, once a week, because they actually couldn't afford to kill the animals. The animals were valuable. But now animals have just become another commodity. And on our farms, even though we've tried to do some cow protection, because we're not actually using them for their natural services, then it's just become a hobby. And there was a lot of enthusiasm to begin with to build up, you know, herds of cows and bulls and bullocks and train them, you know, how to work the land. But we've not had the manpower that's persistent enough to stay with that. And then the cows become a big burden. So our, you know, our farming communities have found themselves burdened with very large herds of cows, and then they've had to reduce them back down again by natural attrition, by not breeding them, and then that means you don't get any more milk. So then the cows become useless, and the bulls, you're not growing any food anyway, so you're not using them. So it's just become a burden. It's like a hobby. And I've seen even in Mayapur in India now, we have our goshala, but they're not using the bulls. They're not using the cows. It's just become a hobby, that's all. And the only way that they can maintain them is by getting life members out of some sentiment to give donations every month to support them. Otherwise, actually, they're costing a lot more than what the return is on them. Why? Because they're not actually being utilized on the land anymore. So there is no return. You're just feeding them, but you're not getting anything back. And in that situation, then you'll become very resentful of them. Oh, you know, useless animals. So it's, you know, we're in a difficult situation in the world in general. And in ISKCON, we're in a difficult situation because we've never done any of this before. So maybe the input, and I think that that's why nothing's happened so far. too much theory but no practical understanding. That's one thing. And the ones who are real advocates of Varnashram tend to be so theoretical and so fanatical about it that they're not practical in any way at all. And therefore they get a lot of opposition from people that are practically minded. So, you know, there's differences of opinion, strong differences of opinion amongst the devotees how to go about doing it. It may not happen until we're forced to do it. Generally speaking, that's, you know, the way that we learn. We have second class intelligence. First class means you hear the theory and then you can practice. And second class means that you hear the theory but you don't do anything, and then later on you're forced to do it, then you learn. So it may be that we'll have to wait until we're forced by circumstances, that we have to fall back on our resources, natural resources. So, you know, personally I'd love to see a Varnashram system come in because Prabhupada wanted it. That's without question. But exactly how and where and when, these are big questions. Alright. Any other questions about anything? Yes, Prabhupada. Reading about how Mukunda was stopped from drinking tea. Well, Prabhupada in principle was against tea drinking because it's like a hobby of the idle. The idle persons in India you see everywhere. They're sitting and drinking their little cups of tea. So you go in the government offices, it seems like every 10 minutes, you know, somebody comes around with these little tiny cups. There's probably one mouthful tea. And they're always drinking tea everywhere you go. Everything's covered with tea stains from the cups. They put them down and you get a circle tea. So, you know, Prabhupada used to see the tea stalls. And of course we don't drink tea anyway, at least not the regular tea, because it has tannin and, you know, these are the stimulants in them. But Prabhupada was just, in general, not happy with the whole mode of tea drinking. Well, a hot drink's all right. But Prabhupada always preferred milk. I mean, his drink was milk. Personally, I like a hot drink, but I don't like drinking milk at night because I can't digest it properly. So, generally, I have some herbal tea. So I can't speak too much about it. But, you know, for me, when I have a hot drink, I feel actually relaxed and rejuvenated. With other people, sometimes they need a cold drink. My wife, she only likes cold drinks. Hot drinks don't do it for her, but, you know, I'm the opposite. So by bodily constitution sometimes, you need a drink, you know, something hot. And if it's not milk, then it'll be something else. So I don't think that, you know, when it's served out as prasadam like that, I think that it's not a bad thing. But if it just becomes like an idleist pastime, that's another thing. Huh? Yeah. Well, in the West, they prefer coffee, I've seen mostly. People like to drink coffee. Coffee is definitely out. And Prabhupada, I believe, I'd have to check on this, but I believe when he was asked, can they serve decaf coffee in the restaurants, he said no, simply because it's coffee. even if it's decaffeinated. But he didn't like it, just in principle, he didn't like it. But he did also say, as I was reading the other day, that when we had our Krishna Balaram was temple was opened and the guest house was there at the back, people were not coming. So Prabhupada said, well, even if we have to serve tea or coffee, you know, just to get people in the door and come and stay, then he was prepared to do that. Because later on we didn't need to do that because, you know, the place became very popular and now you can't get a room for love or money. It's always packed up. But in the early days it was always empty and Prabhupada was complaining about that. So he said, you know, if need be, we can set up a tea stall at the front and then bring them. We won't make it in our temple, but we'll bring it to them. But that's regular tea that he was talking about. So, anyway, regular tea is definitely out under any circumstance. But herbal teas and stuff, it's not a bad thing if when everybody sits down and takes prasadam, there's a bucket full of whatever hot drink that they make. I see most temples do that. You know, devotees like to have a hot drink when they're eating. That's fine. All right. Any other questions? No, no. We're so fortunate that Prabhupada appeared to me in dreams. I wouldn't share it with you anyway. Don't mind. But that's, you know, these are personal events. Sometimes it's something you want to talk about and sometimes it's definitely not. So I have occasionally, very, very occasionally, had dreams, you know, of Srila Prabhupada. But they're not generally things that I talk about. Any other questions? Although Prabhupada did say that if you dream about the spiritual master or Krishna, that is not an illusion, that's reality. They're actually there. Different from ordinary dreams. And Prabhupada told us couple of times about dreams that he had. One time we were sitting on the balcony in Mayapur. It was myself and Tamal Krishna Maharaj. Prabhupada had just finished lunch, and after lunch every day he was going out and sitting on the balcony and looking out from the Lotus building over towards the Ganges. So this particular day he sat down, he said, last night I had a dream about a planet where pious Mohammedans go. So we kind of, you know, he just told us that and we kind of laughed. And then I said, is there actually such a place? And Prabhupada said, oh yes. At that time I was thinking, you know, I never heard of a pious Muslim. Not to be insulting, but you know, they're calculous. This is what they're noted for. At least in India, they kill the cow, so how they can be pious? In fact, they make a point of killing the cow just to agitate the Hindus. So I was thinking, you know, is there such a thing as a pious Hindu? I mean, a pious Muslim. But I asked him, is there such a place, you know, a planet where pious Muslims go? And he said, oh yeah. So whatever he saw, it must have been real. Another time, when I was giving him a massage in Vrindavan, I think this was like September, October time of 76. Prabhupada told me, he said, last night, he said, I had a dream where the whole, you know, in Vrindavan they have this sunken courtyard, yeah, goes down in the middle. So he said, I had a dream, the whole courtyard was filled up with water. And I was thinking, oh, if it comes up one more inch, then everything will be ruined. So then I left, and then I asked him about dreams, whether they're true or not. He said, no, he said, it's just the working of the mind. He said, just like if I take this bottle of oil, and he picked up the oil that I was using to massage him with. He said, and then I put it under the pillow of the bed. He says, does it have any meaning? He said, no, there's no meaning to that. So he was just, you know, dismissing it. But there were other times, then we know, when he told us that he had had dreams when his Guru Maharaj was coming to him and taking him away and telling him, now you have to take sannyas. So that was real. So sometimes, and there was another time in Hyderabad in 76 in December, when we were at the farm there. I'd given Prabhupada his evening massage, and then I went out the room and I had to go to the bathroom to clean something up. And I walked, Prabhupada was sleeping, and I walked past his door, and just as I walked past his door, I heard him call out in his sleep. But it was unintelligible. I couldn't make out what he'd said, but he kind of was quite loud. And then I thought about a purport that Prabhupada had written in the 8th canto, where he said that sometimes the spiritual master has to suffer bad dreams on account of the sinful reactions that he accepts by taking on disciples. So I thought, well, you know, this is why. So there are different features of dreaming. Some of it's real, some of it's not real. Some of it's due to reactions from others. Some of it's just your crazy mind. Some of it is due to impressions from the mind from previous lifetimes. That's in the Bhagavatam, and Prabhupada told me that example. He said the Bhagavatam states that if you see a gold mountain, there is no such thing. But because you've seen gold and you've seen a mountain, maybe you've seen it in a previous lifetime, and now again that image comes out from the mind. So that's a few dreams. I had a dream once. I'll tell you one dream that I had. Not about Prabhupada, but I was with Prabhupada. And I had dreamt that I was in the basement of the Melbourne Temple. We were in Mayapur. I don't know whether I mentioned this or not. Maybe it was in Ljubljana, I told them. Anyway, so I was in this basement of the Melbourne Temple. And as soon as I walked in, the place was lighted up. There was a sink on one side, there was a gas burner at the other end. And as soon as I walked in, I immediately understood there was a ghost in there. And as soon as I walked in, then this ghost, it was very mischievous. So all of a sudden the taps at the sink suddenly were turned full on, and the water's just pouring down. So I thought, you know, the demon, he's wasting Krishna's energy by turning on the taps, letting the water flow. So I ran over and I turned the taps off. And as soon as I turned the taps off, the gas burner at the other end, immediately all the burners came up full, burning the gas. And I thought, you know, this is a real demon. Now he's wasting the gas. So I ran over and started turning off the gas burners. And as I did so, then he came up behind me and started to push me into the flames. So my head was going down into the flames. And so as I was going, my head was going down into the flames, I started to panic a little bit, because I thought I was going to get burnt. And then I thought, I better, you know, chant Hare Krishna. So I started to chant Hare Krishna. When I chanted Hare Krishna, then this ghost got really angry. Then I thought, you know, it's not working, because if you chant Hare Krishna, the ghost is supposed to go away. But then, you know, then immediately I thought, no, that's not right. Krishna's name always is all powerful. And I realized that although my head was being pushed into the flames of the gas burner, nothing was happening. I wasn't feeling any discomfort. So I thought Krishna was protecting me. So as I was thinking like this, the ghost, because he knew what I was thinking, because it's all on the subtle level, he got even more angry and started to push me harder. So then, you know, because he got so ferocious, then I started to chant the Nisringadev mantra. So I started to chant, Namaste, Narasingha, like this. So I chanted it so loudly that I woke myself up. You know, the dream disappeared, and I actually woke myself up. So then I was puzzled, you know, was this real or not? And I was thinking also, you know, I'm in Mayapur, so how is it that there could be a ghost in the dam? So in the morning I told Srila Prabhupada about the dream, and I asked him, are there actually ghosts in the dam? And he said, oh yes. He said, they're also in Vrindavan as well. So then I asked him, I said, well, was that actually a ghost that was attacking me? You know, was it just a dream? So then Prabhupada said, could be either. He said, anyway, it's good that you chant it. So that was his final, it's good that you chant it. So that's one dream that I had. Any other questions? The application of devotional service is flexible. There are standards. If you don't follow those standards, you won't make advancement. But the application and engagement of people from various levels, you know, is very broad and liberal. When Prabhupada was in Mayapur, I think in 77, we were talking a little bit, and Prabhupada, Tamal Krishna Maharaj was there, I was there. And I think what it was that Tamal Krishna Maharaj had a, you know, one of these Acharman cups. It was a copper one, and he hadn't cleaned it, so it was all kind of discolored and stained. In the West, we have a conception, we see copper like that, we think, oh, this is very antique, yeah, very nice. But Prabhupada saw it, said, why don't you clean this? He said, it should be nice and shiny and, you know, clean. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj laughed, and he said, oh, you know, we have this idea that if it's not cleaned, if it's left like that, then it becomes antique. So anyway, we're talking like that, and then at one point Tamal Krishna Maharaj told Srila Prabhupada, he said, the thing is, he said, Srila Prabhupada, you have such a high standard. Then Prabhupada pulled the face and he said, it is not a high standard, it is a low standard. But he said, something, a blind uncle is better than none. So that was his idea. Our idea was a, you know, very high standard. His idea was a very low standard. But he was willing to adjust, just to get us chanting, just to get us eating prasadam. You know, he would do anything practically to get somebody engaged in devotional service. And he told Tamal Krishna Maharaj, it wasn't on that occasion, but on another occasion, I'm not sure what they were talking about. It may have been about somebody that had left the movement and had become, you know, quite fallen. And at one point, you know, Prabhupada was saying, well, somehow or another, try and bring him in and this and that. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj said, well, isn't there, you know, there must be some point, you know, where a person, you know, goes off so much, you know, that you just can't bring them back. And Prabhupada said, no, he said, there are no limits to Lord Chaitanya's mercy. No limits, no matter what a person's done. So, on the one hand, you know, Prabhupada was quite strict. You know, he had standards for deity worship. He had standards for our behavior. You couldn't be initiated unless you promised to follow the four regulative principles and chant your rounds. But on the other hand, in, you know, preaching and just trying to connect people with the chanting and, you know, with the Krishna consciousness movement, Prabhupada could be practically unlimitedly liberal about it. So it depends on the circumstance. It's quite complex. There's no easy formula. And in some circumstances, Prabhupada would be quite strict. And in other circumstances, it would be extremely liberal. And you didn't necessarily always know which, you know, how he was going to react to a particular circumstance. I remember there was one devotee, Chayavana Swami, who was a little mentally disturbed, and he had caused problems in Africa when he was left unsupervised there. So then he left Africa and he came to India. Then we heard that he was running around Radhakund, and he was smoking bidis. Then we heard that he'd come to Calcutta. We were in Mayapur at the time. And then he was running after some woman. Then we heard that he'd gone back, instead of coming to see Prabhupada, he'd gone back again to Radhakund. Then we heard that he'd been arrested, some visa violation, and been thrown in jail. So when Prabhupada heard that, he said, yes, very good. And I was a little bit, you know, kind of puzzled. I thought, you know, Prabhupada would be sympathetic. He said, no. He said, that means that then, because he's been doing nonsense, so then this will mitigate some of his sinful reactions. It's good that he is being punished, because that will clear some of his sinful reactions. But in other circumstances, and Prabhupada heard of a devotee getting into difficulty, he would be very sympathetic. Like with Madhavisa. Madhavisa had, you know, fallen down, you know, a few times with several women, not just one. And Prabhupada knew that, but when he left, he was very disturbed that Pushta Krishna had advertised it. And he told, actually, I mean, what I reported there was not the strongest. I came into the room, you know, just after Prabhupada started chastising Pushta Krishna. But when Pushta Krishna told me, he said, when I first went in, and he gave a report, you know, he said, Prabhupada, I've rung all the temples and informed that Madhavisa's fallen and not to give him any facilities and this and that. And Prabhupada yelled at him, he said, you murderer! He was really upset, because Prabhupada had it in mind that when he eventually got to New York, he was going to talk privately with the man and try to save him. And he was very fond of Madhavisa, actually. Madhavisa was a very, very capable person. He'd done, you know, very well in India and in Australia. And there was one, at one point, Prabhupada said that Madhavisa was his best sannyasi. Then a year later, all this stuff came out, so he was concerned about him. And you'll see later on, when we got to France, about 3 months later, we were, again, there was a report of somebody else having problems, another sannyasi. And then Prabhupada asked me, any news of Madhavisa? So I said, well, we heard he's in Hawaii. And then Prabhupada, his face softened. And you know, he had a very compassionate look on his face. He said, sometimes I feel for Madhavisa. Because he was, you know, fond of him. Because he did a lot of nice service. So, in devotional service, we can be strict and we can also be very liberal. That was the example of Lord Chaitanya. You know, he was very, very strict with Junior Haridas, Chota Haridas. Very strict. To the point when, even when he committed suicide, he said, good. And I saw that side of Prabhupada also. Vishnu Jan Swami was one of the prominent leaders in early ISKCON in America for many years. You know, he was noted for his kirtans. Prabhupada said that he would become famous all over his world, all over the world, for his singing. And he was, you know, generally very happy with him, and he was a very charismatic personality. The devotees loved him. Nobody ever had a bad word to say about Vishnu Jan. Yet in 1976, when he disappeared, you know, he asked Prabhupada this question on the morning walk when we were up on the roof, maybe about the 12th or 13th of March. You know, what was the result? Something about Chota Haridas is committing suicide because of a fall down. And then Prabhupada confirmed, and he said, yes, that is the, you know, proper rectification for a sannyasi who falls. And then there was more discussion, but Vishnu Jan kind of dropped to the back of the group. He didn't participate in the discussion anymore. And then a couple of days later he was gone and he was never seen again. So at the end of the festival, on about the 22nd, Tamal Krishna Maharaj reported to Srila Prabhupada that nobody had seen Vishnu Janaswami now for 4 or 5 days. It's just disappeared. Prabhupada was completely unperturbed. Never registered any concern. He just said, well, if he doesn't want to serve, then you can't force him. That was all he said. And then a couple of months later, we got to Los Angeles. And then, you know, there was some rumor that maybe he'd committed suicide. And he hadn't been seen anyway. And again, Tamal Krishna Maharaj gave this report, you know, that nobody's seen him and maybe that he's committed suicide. Prabhupada said, I don't think so. And I brought it up with him afterward. And again, he was unconcerned. He just, you know, didn't register any emotional reaction at all. And we were a little surprised because Vishnu Jam was such a popular guy, you know. And after Tamal had gone out, then I asked Prabhupada a couple of more questions. And he said, what is that? He said, any sannyasi. I said, well, he hasn't been seen now for, you know, 3 or 4 months. And usually somebody that bloops from the movement, you see them somewhere. Somebody sees them. He hadn't been seen. And Prabhupada said, oh, what is that? He said, a sannyasi, you can go anywhere, any village in India. And they'll immediately give, you know, food and shelter. So at that time he didn't think that he had committed suicide. Then in April of 77, apparently, and I wasn't there for this, but I heard this from Tamal Krishna Maharaj, and I've looked in folio, I can't find any record of this conversation either, so it wasn't recorded. But Tamal Krishna Maharaj, it seemed by that time somebody had gone to Allahabad, I think it was, and done a bit of investigation, and they had heard about a tall Western sadhu who had come there and had paid a boatman to take him out into the middle of the river and had tied a rock around himself and jumped in and just disappeared under the water. So this rumor was going around. And that was reported back to Tamal Krishna Maharaj. He reported that to Srila Prabhupada. And he said, well, no, it's been more than a year. We haven't seen the man anywhere. Now this information's come. So then Prabhupada said, well, then maybe he has committed suicide. And then he said, that's good. And then Tamal Krishna Maharaj, I think, asked him, well, what is his destination? Then he said, then he'll go to the heavenly planets and preach there. So, you know, Prabhupada, again, no negative response. It depends, circumstances, who you're dealing with. You know, some people he would be very, apparently casual with. Some people he would be very concerned about. Some people he would never chastise. Some people he was always chastising, you know. It depends on the personalities involved. And there are recognized standards, but there are also, there's the dispensation of mercy as well. So when we're neophytes, we tend to see everything black and white, you know. If it's not this way, then it's not, you know, it's no good. But the spiritual master, practically speaking, he has to extend himself unlimitedly because he's there to try to save the fallen souls. So he, you know, he may accept somebody even when their behavior is unacceptable to others. But then again, I can think of another letter that Prabhupada wrote. He received a letter from a devotee, I think his name was Lalitanath or Lalitananda or something like that. I have to check it. And this man had left, I think it was about 74 when he got this letter. This man had left the movement and basically he just decided to become a homosexual. So he was living a homosexual lifestyle. Now, I didn't see the letter that he wrote to Prabhupada, But from Prabhupada's response, it seems like this man was asking if he could still be a devotee and still be a homosexual, like a practicing homosexual. And Prabhupada wrote back to him and said, if you insist on living this lifestyle, then you cannot join the temple. You know, and you won't make, and he said, and your spiritual life will be finished. So he was very cut and dried with him. He wasn't going to accept that at all. But yet there were other devotees that were trying, who had the same problem, but were trying, you know, to be devotees, and they were trying to live up to the standards, not always being successful, but Prabhupada always encouraged them. But this man wanted to have his sinful life and still try to be a devotee. Now, Prabhupada wasn't having any of it. So it requires a little, you know, again, it's one of those things that requires a little maturity and wisdom. And one person may respond to a situation in a particular way. Another person may have another way of responding to it. Both of them may be correct. You know, sometimes if you're too liberal with somebody, it doesn't help them. And you should be strict. Sometimes if you're strict with somebody, then, you know, it actually helps them more. And sometimes it's the reverse. Prabhupada told me in Calcutta in 77 that somebody has to be advanced if you want to be able to chastise them. He said, you can only chastise somebody who's advanced. He said, if he's not advanced and you chastise him, then he'll crack. And then he'll go away and he'll be finished. So, you know, you have to judge the situations, the persons involved. Sometimes they need encouragement, sometimes they need chastisement. It depends on them. Yeah. Yeah. But we have to err on the side of compassion. You know, better to keep somebody who's not really fit than to drive away somebody who may be fit or has the possibility to become fit. Yeah. At least that way, then, you know, that principle of mercy can continue. But if you get too, you know, this is the problem Prabhupada said. That was the reason why the Brahmanas fell from grace in India. Because they were so strict that anybody who apparently deviated even the slightest little bit from, you know, the Vanashram standards that they wanted, then they would ostracize them completely from Hindu society. Then those people, they would be, you know, in January it was the lower class people. So they would be, you know, without any position in Hindu society, they'd just become Muslims. Because the Muslims would accept anybody. So in that way, Prabhupada said, the whole Brahminical culture was ruined in India. He said if the Brahmanas had been more liberal, or if they'd have been more compassionate, then there wouldn't have been nearly as much problems, you know, with an ever-increasing Muslim community, which was at odds with them. They hated them because the Brahmanas were driving them out. If a Muslim went up to somebody and just sprinkled water on them, the Brahmanas would ostracize that person from Hindu society. Now you're no longer a Hindu. Why? Because a Muslim threw some water on you. So they forced them to become Muslims. So being overly strict is not good. You know, this is smarter Brahman stuff. The smarter Brahmins didn't like Lord Chaitanya's movement. Why? Because Haridas Thakur, who was a Muslim, was the Namacharya. They couldn't tolerate that. They couldn't tolerate the fact that Shudras were joining his movement. you know, and chanting the holy names. They thought it was wrong. So our history is one of being very liberal, actually. Although we have the highest standards, but also the most liberal. So how to put those two together, that requires a lot of wisdom and, you know, compassion. Not an easy task. In general, if somebody was willing to try, Prabhupada was always willing to give him a go. But if somebody was deliberately doing nonsense, then he would say, then he cannot stay. He has to go out. There were certain limitations. Didn't mean that they couldn't chant Hare Krishna wherever they were, but to live in a temple, that required some standards. So he wasn't prepared to tolerate anything in the temples. But he was prepared to keep on encouraging people, you know, even if they were very fallen, he would still try to do something for them. But in the temple, you have to keep some standards. And of course, Prabhupada's laid those out, exactly what they are. That's not difficult to understand. We used to have a rule, no crazies. Right? Nobody who's crazy can live it. Because in the early days, we had that liberal attitude. Anybody that chants Hare Krishna, let them come and stay in the temple. And you get all these actually crazy people, you know, that would come and they would live in the Brahmachari ashram or Brahmachari ashram and cause a complete disturbance for the sane people that were there, you know. And then sane people won't join. So eventually we had to get to the point where, you know, okay, that's it, no crazies. You know, alright, come around, take prasadam, chant Hare Krishna, but don't live here. So you have to know how to apply the proper standards. Okay, so it's 9:30. It's very late. So I hope that was satisfactory. Tomorrow we'll have class. I may read from another segment of the seminar tomorrow, actually, a different one. Maybe what we'll do tomorrow is we'll read about Prabhupada's standards of cleanliness. That's an important item. When I was in Split, we did the whole segment on prasadam. So you can get the files for that. And tomorrow we'll do one segment on cleanliness. Okay? Tomorrow morning, I'm flying out in the afternoon. I've got to go to the festival in the Ukraine, so tomorrow will be the last session, tomorrow morning. Okay? Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.